Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Bringing Artificial Intelligence into Diagnostics and Clinical Practice. The presenter is Leo Grady, PhD, CEO, Jonah, Darien, Connecticut.
Thank you everybody for coming back in from the break and making time today. So Ajit asked me, so my talk today is about bringing AI into diagnostics and clinical practice. And as Ajit mentioned, I had my PhD in AI 20 years ago. I had the pleasure of working with Ajit and some wonderful people at Siemens building AI in radiology. Then I was at a company called HeartFlow. We built a cardiovascular diagnostic test for coronary disease. That was a combination of AI and computational fluid dynamics, as well as a virtual stenting application that allowed you to put in a virtual stent and see what was going to happen. These were all FDA-approved AI applications, NICE recommendations, the first time Medicare had ever paid for an AI product in healthcare. And then I was CEO of Page AI, which built the first FDA-approved AI system in pathology for prostate cancer. After Page, I worked on the investor side for a little bit and then started a new company, Jonah, that I'm going to tell you a little bit about in a moment. Now, I often get asked, you know, because of this history in AI, why don't we see it more? And what is holding back AI from widespread clinical adoption? And it's not technology. It's not regulatory. There's really one thing that is holding back AI from widespread adoption in clinical practice, and that's getting paid for AI. So the reason to focus on this is because the expectations for AI in healthcare are very high, and they should be. People want AI to be robust. They want it to be unbiased, to be tested on all sorts of populations. They want AI to be dependable, reliable, accurate, and clinically validated. But you know what? We can do all of these things with modern AI technology. The thing is that to build AI that reaches this clinical standard costs money. And you can raise that money from an investor, but if no one's willing to pay for that clinical grade AI on the back end, then it's very difficult to justify building it in the first place. And so when it comes to getting paid for AI, I think there's really two aspects to it that are really essential. The first is the business model, you know, how you're actually selling AI into practice and how you're adopting it, as well as the perception of value. So with AI in healthcare, there are really five business models. There's this vertical integration where AI is one part of the product, but you're buying the overall product. You know, it's something we were doing at Siemens, but you also see it with Butterfly, RadNet, other companies. You can have AI as a medical device, you know, CPT codes, reimbursement, go through the full FDA pathway and get paid for use of AI. You can drive efficiency, as we heard in the last talk, that you can go after value-based care. This is also another way in which you can justify the value of AI. Or you can forget the clinic completely and sell to pharma or give away a product to the clinic and then harvest the data and sell that to pharma. And then the last model for AI in healthcare is actually cash pay. And we see this with some of the digital health companies, some of the more consumer-focused companies. But there are also companies like Grail, which are offering their test cash pay. It's not an AI product, but there are AI products that are in that space. Now, the other element to getting paid for, and I should say on the business model topic, not one business model has really emerged as dominant or, you know, to be frank, really working to really justify the costs of building AI. I think we have success stories here and there, but they're really taking advantage of, you know, certain structural aspects in healthcare. So the other aspect is perception of value. And what I mean by perception of value is it's a psychological state about a product or a technology where the perceived value is higher than the cost, you're going to buy it. If the perceived value is lower than the cost, you're going to pass. And there are a lot of aspects of perception of value. You have actual value, you know, data and studies. You've got scarcity, urgency, FOMO, the brand of the company, the testimonials from trusted customers, and the price. However, I think the thing that is unique to AI in terms of perception of value is comparators. So if I launch a new syringe, you know it's not $1 million. I don't need to tell you anything about how fancy the syringe is. You have some idea of what the cost is. But when I launch a new AI, it's not at all clear to people what they should be paying for it. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that people's perception of what AI is, or their comparator of what AI is something like this, right? I mean, this is what people are thinking of. They're thinking of a robot doctor or somebody who's going to automate a clinical professional. And if that is your mode of thinking about AI, then it's very hard to assign a value. You start doing these calculations like, well, if I can save 15 minutes, you know, so on and so on, then that there's some value to that, and trying to bake in the value from that. And I think this is actually a very terrible comparator for AI and healthcare. And I think going down this road, you know, either as a company brand or when you're talking about AI, really diminishes the real perception of value. And what I want to say is that perception of value is really a psychological state. It's not about the technology. And to illustrate that point, if you imagine a new technology where you can sample somebody's blood and you can measure bits of tumor that have flecked off in that blood and diagnose somebody with cancer, you know, you could think of this technology in different ways. You could think of it as a blood test, right? And if you're comparing that to a blood test, you know, then you're going to be in the sort of $50 to $200 range for what that technology is. But there's another way to think about this same technology, which is as a replacement for a biopsy, right? And when you think about this technology as a replacement for a biopsy, now suddenly you're looking at this as, you know, several thousands of dollars. And so the marketing geniuses out there that have been, you know, bringing this technology to market have called this a liquid biopsy. And that name really kind of puts people on the more, on the right side, on that high value comparator. And as such, you see something like Grail's price is $950 for it. But it's not a question of the technology. I mean, you could just as easily put it in the mental category of a blood test, but then the perception of value is going to be much lower. So now I want to talk about how I've applied all of these lessons to Jonah, to my new company, both the business model and the perception of value. So to begin with, if you look through my history, we were always building AI that could extract real value out of data that we did not acquire, right? So in the HeartFlow case, you know, we weren't acquiring CT, we weren't building cardiac CT, we weren't seeing patients, but we were building AI that could create value from that data. And that's what we did and others have done in that space. And likewise, at Page, we weren't running labs, we weren't building scanners, we weren't cutting tissue. We were building AI that could really deliver value based on that digitized data. And similarly, at Jonah, we're focused on the microbiome. We're not running labs, we're not sequencing, we're not generating the data. We're really focused on how to create value from this very complex data. So why the gut microbiome? You may have seen things about the microbiome, both in the scientific and clinical press, as well as the lay press, Nature, Science, but Scientific American and The Economist. And with good reason. The microbiome has been linked to nearly every system and health condition in the body at this point. Everything from GI disease, Crohn's, colitis, celiac, food allergies, autoimmune conditions, chronic fatigue syndrome, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis. You have metabolic disease, obesity and diabetes, oncology, colorectal cancer, pancreatic cancer have all been linked with the microbiome. Through this gut-brain axis, we're seeing early signs of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, as well as depression and anxiety linked with the gut microbiome, skin disease, liver disease, cardiovascular disease, and even performance. Healthy aging and fitness performance have all been linked with the gut microbiome. And the public is paying attention too, and they're spending money on things like probiotics and kefir and kombucha, and they're spending a lot of money. You know, in 2020, $54 billion were spent on probiotics and probiotic foods by consumers. Now, most of this is probably snake oil, and it doesn't do anything for these individuals. I think the point for me is that people are paying attention, the public is paying attention, and they're willing to spend money out of pocket to try to improve their health. Now, they're also buying microbiome tests as well, and you can order these. Many of you can probably run them in your labs. These are mostly PCR panels, and you see results like this. You know, it's a long list of different species, and you say, okay, well, some of them are high, some of them are low. It's not very actionable. I mean, unless somebody has a pathogen, and you say, okay, well, we'll give them antibiotics or antifungals, and all of the connections to Parkinson's disease and cancer and Crohn's disease that we saw in the previous slide, there's just zero connection that you get out of one of these tests to all of that amazing science. And I think a big reason why it's very difficult to make that connection is the complexity of the microbiome. If you look at a condition like obesity, you know, it's not a single organism that's higher in obese people or lower in obese people. It's an ecosystem shift, right? It's a complete compositional change in the microbiome that has been linked to obesity. As another example, different ecosystem shifts have been linked with drug response. GLP-1 drugs don't work for everybody, and it's been shown that the pretreatment microbiome can be predictive of responders and non-responders and GLP-1s. But again, it's not a simple one-to-one correlation of one organism is high or low. It's a real compositional structure of the microbiome that predicts efficacy or non-efficacy of these drugs. So it's complex. And one of the exciting things about the microbiome is that you can change it. You can change it through diet, through lifestyle, through supplements, also through medications. But these changes are also complex. This is a review of different shifts that happen when you adopt different dietary changes. And what you see is that, you know, for example, with a vegan diet, some organisms go down, some organisms go up. And it's not at all, you know, it's not simple that it's just a shift in like one organism or in one taxa. So these microbiome changes are also complex. In addition, the microbiome literature is confusing. You know, take Akkermansia, which is an organism that feeds off the mucus layer in your gut. There have been a number of studies that showed when Akkermansia is really low, it can have very bad outcomes. Low Akkermansia has been linked with Crohn's disease and colitis and many other issues. And as a result, there's been a whole rash of probiotics that have come out that'll give you Akkermansia, and people are flocking to. But then if you keep reading the literature, the Akkermansia has also been linked with Parkinson's disease when it's too high, right? So it's not that Akkermansia is good or it's bad. It's like you need it in a certain range to really not be on the Crohn's end or on the Parkinson's end. So the literature is complex, and it's really actually getting worse. This is the number of microbiome studies in PubMed over the last 20 years. As of today, every month, there are about 2,000 papers being published on the microbiome in PubMed. Nobody can read all of these. So what we did at Jonah is we built a custom AI, reads the microbiome literature, and can interpret a microbiome test, and then provide actionability on what you can do about it. So let me go into how that works. So basically, we take a microbiome test result, and then the AI matches all of the patterns in that microbiome test result to every study that's ever been published on the microbiome. So we can say, this person's microbiome shows the signature for Crohn's or colitis or IBS or celiac food allergy, whatever it is, right? And then the AI reads all of the interventional literature, and we create a virtual microbiome, a digital twin of the individual's microbiome, where we say, what happens if this person goes vegan, right? And we apply that shift of the microbiome from the literature to their virtual microbiome. And then we make a virtual keto version of that person, a virtual, you know, gluten-free version of that person, put that virtual person on metformin or rapamycin or whatever it is. And we create all of these virtual microbiomes for an individual. And then we look at those virtual people and we say, is that virtual vegan version of this person more strongly associated with Crohn's disease or less? Are they more strongly associated with ulcerative colitis or less? And then we ask either their care provider or the patient themselves, what are your health goals? What sort of outcomes are you trying to achieve? And then we help them select the actions, the interventions that, you know, create the virtual them that is going to best align with their health goals. So this is really going beyond just a PCR panel or just a compositional understanding of the microbiome to understand, using AI to interpret these results, create value out of these results, and provide concrete actions that people can take within the bounds of today's science to actually improve their health. Now, in terms of the business model aspect of what I talked about before, we are selling this product cash pay. It's not a medical device because we're just reading the literature. It's not a diagnostic. We are just, in theory, if somebody were to read all 250,000 papers that have been published on the microbiome, they should come to exactly the same conclusions. We just do it for them with the AI. So we're selling to academic medical centers that want to provide enhanced care, executive health, concierge medicine, longevity centers, dietitians, weight loss clinics, some GI private practices. But there's this trend also within fitness gyms starting to offer testing. You know, Lifetime Fitness opened a longevity center in Minneapolis last year where they're doing a lot of diagnostic testing. Equinox just announced a partnership with Function Medicine to provide diagnostic testing to their clients. We also see health spas are growing, and they're also doing diagnostic testing to help people improve, you know, beauty and appearance. So there's a real rich world of cash pay testing that's happening out there, and a real hunger for consumers to want to take control of their own health and really want to be able to, you know, achieve their health goals. At Jonah, we also sell direct-to-consumer. We sell a version of this product, direct-to-consumer. It's not our primary channel, but it's an area where we believe that we can better serve the public and be accessible and then funnel them into partners, clinics that, you know, can better serve their needs as if they have anything more serious that they need medical attention for. Okay, that's it. Thank you all.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.